Welcome to Registry Matters, an independent production. Our opinions are our own. We are thankful for our patrons. You make what we do here possible. Your support keeps the conversation going. And always remember, FYP.
Recording live from FYP Studios East and West, transmitting across the internet. This is episode 365 of Registry Matters. Good evening, sir. How are you?
Doing awesome. How are you?
I'm fantastic. I'm waiting for Snowmageddon to arrive. And that can lead you to think that I live pretty much anywhere from, I don't know, Maine to Florida almost.
You've got a wide swath on the storm, but I have a premonition you're somewhere halfway, maybe a third of the way up the seaboard.
That could possibly be true. My uncle told me that he is going to receive something of like 30 inches, and he's near where the conference is going to be. He's in Baltimore.
How many inches did you say?
He said like 30 something. He said like a couple feet of snow is coming towards him.
Now that's going to be funny.
That is a lot. For that area especially, you know, they certainly can handle some stuff, but it's not that aggressive there.
No, if you're in the D.C., which Baltimore's not far from D.C., they're not equipped for 2 feet of snow.
They are not. I grew up in that area. All right. Well, so please remember, like, subscribe, thumbs up. What's the, I guess YouTube, it's the thumbs up. How many thumbs up do you think we get in an episode, Larry? We should start trying to set some kind of goal, and we'll try to achieve how many thumbs up that we're going to get from people.
Well, I usually see a dozen up to 20 a thumbs up on the...
Oh, so we should try to achieve. We are going to try to achieve by the time, next time we record, we want to have 25 thumbs up.
Well, that's
on this
right.
Episode plus, of 365.
Plus 10 more subscribers.
Oh, that would be amazing. Yeah, and so, all right, well, tell me what we're going to do tonight.
Well, we have some good news from the United States Supreme Court that's caused quite a bit of chatter, and people are probably just shy of euphoric.
Okay.
And we plan to review a legislative proposal that's currently pending in Arizona. And we have a listener comment that deals with last-minute international travel.
Well, very well. Then let's dive right in, as people would say. So during the episode last week, you discussed the need to travel international and how there was no provision for exigent circumstances. Please reference URL, and I will put it in the show notes. And it contains this language, and it's paragraph 2, I guess that would be, says defense. A PFR may have an affirmative defense to liability as provided in 18 U.S. Code 2250 subsection C. If uncontrollable circumstances prevented the PFR from complying with SORNA, where the PFR did not contribute to the creation of those circumstances in reckless disregard of the requirement to comply and complied as soon as the circumstances prevented compliance ceased to exist, that is worded really roundabout, Larry. So it says example 3, paragraph 2, A2, whatever. A PFR needs to travel to a foreign country on short notice, less than 21 days, because of an unforeseeable family or work emergency. The PFR would have a defense to liability for failing to report the intended travel 21 days in advance, as required by subsection 72.7F, because it is impossible to report an intention to travel outside the United States before the intention exists. However, if the PFR failed to inform the registration jurisdiction, albeit on short notice, once he intended to travel, 18 U.S. Code 2250C would not excuse that failure because the preventing circumstances, absent of an intent to travel abroad, would no longer exist. Wow. This appears to address the exact circumstances referenced in the podcast. Fred, all right. So what do you say to that?
Well, since I'm not authorized to give a legal opinion, I'll give a lay opinion. But the wording is all I need to read to tell me what I need to know. It says in the beginning, a PFR may have an affirmative defense to liability. Well, now that's a pretty ambiguous state statement may have an affirmative defense. And I would like it to be a little more solidified that there is actually a provision where it says this 21-day advance requirement is not enforceable if the following circumstances exist. I'd like more specificity. So this is a bunch of mays, but when you have an affirmative defense, that means that only comes into play once you have been charged, once you've had to lawyer up, once you've had to spend money and have the stress of a criminal proceeding against you, and once you've admitted that you did what allows you to assert the affirmative defense. So you have to go ahead and stipulate that you traveled without notice. And then you have to hope the trier of fact buys your affirmative defense. It's kind of like self-defense. That's an affirmation. Yeah, I've shot the son of a bitch, but here's why. And you have to hope that they believe that your reason is justified. That is not enough for me to want to travel. And I can only speak for myself. If I had a fear of international travel, this would not ease that fear at all.
All right. So the story that we were covering last week or last 2 weeks ago was the guy would fly out of country on short notice to deliver, like, I guess, tourist passengers going to Mexico or packages or whatever he was delivering. And they're like, hey, dude, you're on the flight schedule for tomorrow or the next day or the next day, some, you know, 3 or 4 days away or something like that. And he's like, well, I can't do that because I have to give the 21-day notice. So this would be potentially an out for him. But as you said, it's almost like you're like driving your wife to the hospital because she's pregnant and you're hauling ass down the road and the cop pulls you over. You're like, but she's pregnant. And the guy's like, oh, okay, but meanwhile, you did have to stop. I know you didn't get arrested. I'm toning this thing way down, Larry, but that sounds sort of similar, that the cop has now stopped you, and you had to then assert that your wife is pregnant as you're taking her to the hospital.
That's a good comparison. And what I was really stressing as my point is I don't know that you've entered the country. Now, I know that we've had an expert talk to us post-show last week.
Yes.
That said you have entered the country.
Yep.
But just because he said it, it doesn't make it so.
From this person, it does. I'm just kidding.
So, but he said that as far as he's concerned, you've entered the nation. But I'm looking at the language of the statute and what it's trying to prevent. At least it appears to me what it's trying to prevent is people that are going around the country scoping out their next target. If you're never allowed to leave the tarmac, you are technically on that country's soil, but you haven't been admitted to the country to freely roam. So that's the litigation I would like to see ensue, is whether or not landing on a runway and pulling up to a gate and handing some paperwork and picking up a passenger constitutes entering the country for this particular purpose. That's what I was saying. But this stuff here, I wanted to put it out there because there is this vague language apparently, and if people feel comfortable with it, go ahead and travel and see what happens.
Just, I guess, have an attorney on speed dial too, right?
Right.
Or already have one that you've scoped out and saying, I'm going to do this and this could come up. And so expect a call from this number and bail me out and all that. And that I'm assuming this is not a $10 like retainer, is it?
It would be far more than that for a federal criminal charge that you'd be trying to get ahead of. I think you'd be looking at several thousands of dollars to have an attorney that's going to work with you on this.
Good grief. Very well. Anything else before we head over to the main event?
The main event? How did we get to the main event so fast?
I know, right? We're 8 minutes and 50 seconds in. And so this is out of Reason Magazine, but I mean, I know it's other places. And Justice Thomas, joined by Justice Gorsuch, argue for broader scope of constitutional ban on ex post facto laws. The U.S. Supreme Court has ruled unanimously in Ellenberg versus United States that restitution is criminal punishment. Restitution is where you have to pay money back to the state for your crime, or does that go to the victim?
Theoretically, it goes to the victim, but the state collects it on behalf of the victim.
Okay, sure. Because you don't want, right, like, hi, I'm here to pay my bill as you're knocking on their door. According to the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, and that's NACDL, this is a definitive rejection of the legal fiction that it is merely a civil remedy. And I got to ask you, do you agree with that?
I do. And according to NACDL's executive director, you can't just slap a civil label on a penalty to bypass the Constitution and keep people under the government's thumb forever. She went on to say, this ruling is a victory for the rule of law and the thousands of individuals who have been shackled by debt long after their prison cells were opened. We have finally recognized that you cannot separate restitution from the Constitution. It's time for a system that offers true restoration and dignity rather than permanent cycle of despair. End of quote. Now, that's a nice quote.
All right. And Mr. Ellenberg saw a 7,500 debt nearly double due to interest added decades after his original conviction. According to Andrew Burrell, for many, the end of a prison sentence is just the start of a second invisible sentence.
Burrell did say that, and he went on to say, we are talking about people who have served their time but are still barred from renting an apartment, getting a driver's license, I think a little hyperbole there, or even opening a bank account because of debt they can never hope to pay. Are you really not allowed to get a driver's license or open a bank account if you owe restitution? I don't know that that's the case. The Supreme Court finally called it what it is. It's punishment. When courts are forced to impose enormous debt on people with no income, it doesn't help victims or build stronger communities. It just deprives people who have served their sentences of the opportunity to rebuild their lives.
The case just decided by the United States Supreme Court decided January 20th, which is 4 days ago. There's been some chatter about it over the past few days, and some have said it will change how the courts analyze constitutional challenges in the future. Now, again, I got to ask you what your opinion of that is.
I am not quite that optimistic.
You just can't help yourself, can you? You are definitely the definition of Mr. Doom and Gloom. The case is about the Mandatory Victims Restitution Act of 1996. The MVRA requires defendants convicted of certain federal crimes to pay monetary restitution to victims. Although petitioner Ellenberg committed his crime before the MVRA's enactment, he was sentenced under the MRVA and ordered to pay $7,567.25 in restitution. Ellenberg raised an ex post facto clause challenge to his continued restitution obligation. The Eighth Circuit concluded that restitution under the MVRA is not criminal punishment subject to the ex post facto clause. The Supreme Court reversed. Can you at least admit that that's some kind of positive change?
Yeah, I can admit that.
All right. Well, then, before we review all of the details, what did the court decide?
The court held that restitution under the MVRA is plainly criminal punishment for purposes of the ex post facto clause.
Now, I noticed something I've never seen before in all these different things that we've read. On page one of the opinion, they stated, in this court, Ellenberg and the United States agree that the Eighth Circuit erred and that MVRA restitution is criminal punishment. Now, what is done when the parties agree?
Well, that is kind of a bizarre thing. It happened like in the Defense of Marriage Act when the Obama administration said, we throw in the towel, we agree with the challengers. Well, that's what happened here. But another party represents the prevailing position, you know, the position below, whether it was prevailing or in this case it was, but they represent the position below when the parties that are true parties to the controversy have no interest in pursuing it. So the Supreme Court appointed a person named John F. Bash as amicus curiae to defend the judgment of the Eighth Circuit.
Did Mr. Bash do a good job?
Well, the court stated that he did a very fine job, but sometimes you can't do, you have bad facts to work with. So, but yes, they said they committed the job that he did.
Well, now that it's story time with Larry, what did he argue to defend the judgment?
Well, amicus contended that Ellenberg's restitution was not imposed under the MVRA, even though he was sentenced after the MVR took effect in 1996. And that's you got to give him credit. That's pretty funny. And they said, therefore, it did not apply to him. But the Eighth Circuit decided the case on the understanding that the MVRA was applied, should be applied, and was applied to Ellenberg.
How did the Supreme Court come to its decision that MVRA violates the ex post facto clause?
That's kind of ironic that you asked that. The court stated whether a law violates the ex post facto clause requires evaluating whether the law imposes criminal or penal or a penal sanction as opposed to a civil remedy. That sounds very familiar. And that question is one of statutory construction that requires the court to consider the statute's text and its structure. And they cited Smith versus Doe from the U.S. Supreme Court as their guiding principle.
Wait a minute. Did you just say Smith versus Doe, the Smith versus Doe, the one that everyone runs around about
yes.
for PFRs?
Yes, Smith versus Doe. That's the case they cited.
I thought that's what you said. That explains why everyone is euphoric, because Smith versus Doe was used as part of their decision in this case.
It was, and they stated, when viewed as a whole, the MVRA makes abundantly clear that restitution is criminal punishment. The MVRA labels restitution as a penalty for a criminal offense, and they cited the code section, and I don't need to go into that, but it's here. And only a criminal defendant convicted of a qualifying crime may be ordered to pay restitution. Restitution is imposed at sentencing for that offense together with other criminal punishments such as imprisonment and fines. And a sentencing proceeding where the restitution is imposed, the government, not the victim, is the party adverse to the defendant. Further, the federal MVRA restitution regime is codified in Title 18, which is Crimes and Criminal Procedure, and the statutory provisions authorizing restitution orders are contained in Chapter 232 of that same title, entitled Miscellaneous Sentencing Provisions. So I hope people listen to all that rant that is considerably different than the PFR registration that's imposed, which is not a part of your sentence. It's a collateral consequence. But go ahead.
All right. In the syllabus, the court stated, while Congress intended restitution under the MVRA to both punish offenders and compensate victims, victims cannot initiate or settle the restitution process as they would if it were a civil proceeding. The text and structure of the Act demonstrates that Congress intended restitution under the Act to impose criminal punishment. What do you make of that?
Well, my take is that PR4 registration, on the other hand, is not as clear-cut when it comes to the intent of the process. It's not clear at all that the process is intended to punish based on the language that lawmakers use. On the contrary, the very preamble to every PFR registration scheme I've seen declares just the opposite. So this is where you become doom and gloom again. You're already comparing apples and oranges, and you're reading way, way too much into this.
Interesting. All right. And then what else did they use to determine that it is punishment?
They stated, as a further sign that MVRA restitution is criminal punishment, the federal MVRA registration regimen is codified in Title 18, Crimes and Criminal Procedure. The main statutory provisions authorizing orders is 3663 and 3663A are contained in Chapter 232, entitled Miscellaneous Sentencing Provisions. That is not the case with PFR registration. So,
can they just move the section out of Crimes and Criminal Procedure?
They can, but the court stated another statutory provision, 3556, states the court shall order restitution in imposing sentence for a covered offense. So that sure sounds a lot like punishment when they say they shall order restitution. On the PFR, it says that the court shall apprise the defendant of a duty to register if one exists, but they don't actually order it. Now, they do order it as a condition of your probation, but that ends when your probation terminates. That provision, as we were just talking about, 3556, is housed in Chapter 227 of Title 18, and that is entitled Sentences. And they will have to deal with that as well if they're just going to try to move it out.
Now, an email that we received, everyone and everyone else that I've heard of, is all giddy that Smith versus Doe was listed in this case. The scuttlebutt is that we should interpret that they are ready to revisit Smith versus Doe. Now, I got to ask you here, do you agree with that?
No, I don't actually agree with that. They actually said, and they're referring to the person that they appointed, amicus relies heavily on Smith versus Doe. That's 538 U.S., beginning at page 84. There, this court, now I'm reading from them, there, this court considered a law requiring a defendant convicted of certain crimes to register as a PFR. The court held that the registration mandate was civil. The legislature adapted distinctly civil procedures for the imposition of registration requirements. And then they cited back to that same case. By contrast, to reiterate what we've said above, MVR restitution is labeled as a penalty, as codified in the criminal code, as predicated on a criminal conviction, as imposed against a criminal defendant, is sometimes imposed in lieu of other penalties, is ordered at sentencing for the United States as the adverse party, and can result in resentencing when the defendant refuses to pay. So Smith versus Doe, this is the court saying that, does not control. Now, I'm reading from what they said, so take their word for it. They are telling you it does not control anything here.
So is this just an example of a renegade court that is overruling the will of the people?
No, I don't think so. It's a court that remains consistent with their previous holdings in Smith versus Doe. They stated it's true, as Amicus thoroughly explains, that MVRA seeks to compensate crime victims, a non-punitive goal. Several provisions of the MVRA reflect that objective, such as provision requiring the restitution amounts to be based on the victim's loss. But these provisions show only that Congress intended restitution under the MVRA to both punish and compensate. And so, and as long as the text and structure of the act demonstrate that Congress intended to at least impose punishment, that ends the inquiry. And if you guys will read Smith versus Doe, they tell you when they're deciding whether something is civil or regulatory, they look at first the intent. And if there is no intent to punish, then they look at the effects. They do the intents of effects test. Congress declared in this they intended to punish. They don't need to go any further. They've already got the answer to what determines if it's punishment because Congress said it was. That changes everything in this analysis.
Now, I need you to step out on the edge of everything that you know, the deep inside of the core of your body. Can you find something that is at least positive?
Yeah. This is a good decision that we should all applaud. Unfortunately, it's not what people think. They stated, this is the court, our ruling today does not mean that a restitution statute can never be civil. But the statutory text and structure of the MVRA demonstrate that restitution under that act, listen carefully, under that act is criminal punishment. That's an invitation for you to fix it. All Congress has to do is make some changes, and I predict that they will.
What do you make of Justice Thomas's separate concurring opinion?
I did not read it in its entirety, but based on what I did read, it appears that he would go further than his colleagues chose to go.
And what makes you say that?
He stated, I joined the court's opinion in full because it correctly applies our precedent. I write separately to clarify the foundation of that precedent. This court's 1798 decision in Calder versus Bull established that the ex post facto clauses forbid only those retroactive laws that impose punishment for a crime. Over the 228 years since Calder, the court has struggled to articulate what it means for a law to impose punishment for a crime and thus be subject to the ex post facto clause. This court's more recent precedents have implemented Calder through two multi-factor tests that largely turn on whether the legislature labels the law as criminal or civil. But in 1798, punishment for a crime would have been understood to refer to any coercive penalty for a public wrong. End of Justice Thomas's quote that I chose to put in here.
Now tell me what was the environment like back in 1798 when you were alive back then, isn't that true?
Yes, I remember those days quite fondly. As Justice Thomas stated, many laws that are normally nominally civil today would therefore have been subject to the ex post facto clauses under Calder. He stated, I would restore Calder's approach to the ex post facto clauses. Now, that's something to get a little bit giddy about because Thomas wants a broader interpretation of the ex post facto clauses, but he didn't have any of his eight colleagues join him on this. I only saw his name on this, and I didn't read the whole thing, but I see only one justice saying that. You've got about But you got to get at least four more to get to five, right?
I believe so. Can you dig into that a little bit more? And what you're like, I understand that he's saying we should go back to 1798. But when you were in your ute back then, I don't understand what that means.
Well, he's saying that they've got this multifaceted test now, where they have to look at whether it's intended to be civil, and what the legislative body intended, and then they have to look at the effects and see if it actually imposes punishment. He's saying, if I interpret it correctly, that any adverse thing done to you as a result of committing a crime should be considered punishment. That's what I think he's saying. And if he's saying that, that's something to get giddy about, because all you've got is four more to go.
And since he is like one of the most conservative traditionalists out there, what's the textualist out there, then I would imagine that you would at least end up with Gorsuch on there. He's very textualisty.
Well, but he didn't join this.
I'm with you.
So, like I say, right now we've only got one. But I would not get all excited about this decision.
And you also then said they have this quote unquote test. Is that the Kennedy Mendoza thing?
Yes, that's where they come up with that Kennedy Mendoza Martinez test. So they start with, did the lawmakers intend to impose punishment? Well, that ends the inquiry. Because if you intend it to be punitive, the court takes the word that, yeah, you want punishment, we agree it's punishment. But if it's clear that the lawmakers were calling it civil and non-punitive and regulatory, then you have to look at the effects. And he's thinking that's way too complicated. If you're being disadvantaged after you committed a crime, after it was a disadvantage that existed, he seems to be saying, we shouldn't be doing that. And he wants to restore the previous approach to the ex post facto clause. If that's what he's saying, I agree, don't you?
I think I do, sure. All right. So,
are you a first-time listener of Registry Matters? Well, then make us a part of your daily routine and subscribe today. Just search for Registry Matters through your favorite podcast app. Hit the subscribe button and you're off to the races. You can now enjoy hours of sarcasm and snark from Andy and Larry on a weekly basis. Oh, and there's some excellent information thrown in there too. Subscribing also encourages others of you people to get on the bandwagon and become regular Registry Matters listeners. So what are you waiting for? Subscribe to Registry Matters right now. Help us keep fighting and continue to say FYP.
Well, we are moving along at high speed here. Do you want to talk about a bill in Arizona?
In what state?
Arizona.
So, yes, we do have a bill to talk about that I was asked by some Arizona advocates to give my analysis of. And I thought this would be helpful to the audience to understand what I look at. And you can either agree or disagree. That's the beauty of our free society, but this is how I break this bill down and what I would do if I had this facing me.
All right. And so it's a very short bill. I will read the relevant portions. A defendant who is ordered or required to register pursuant to section 13-3821 for an offense committed in this state or another state and in violation of this title, and who has been registered as a PFR for at least 10 years for an offense committed as an adult, or for at least 5 years for an offense committed when the defendant was under 18 years of age, may petition the court for an order to terminate any duty to register. Who's the sponsor of this?
The sponsor's name is Representative Powell.
Not Colin Powell?
No, he's been dead for 23 years now.
Actually,
he died, I think, right during the pandemic, so not quite 23 years.
Okay. Does he have the ability? Is he a person that is in a position to move this through the process?
Well, let's dig into this a little bit, because you've heard me say through the years that when you're seeking sponsorship for something good, or if you're evaluating something that's bad, the first thing you have to analyze is, do they have the ability to move the legislation? Well, at first blush, the first thing that stuck out to me is the guy just got elected. He's a freshman. So okay. Normally that would say no.
All right.
But I can't say no in this particular case, because he's a conservative Republican, which is a very good start in a state like Arizona. And that means very few will criticize him for turning loose a tidal wave of crime on the helpless citizens of the state of Arizona. So he's a freshman. That's usually a strike against you. I didn't check out his committee assignments, but he, being that he's on the conservative side of the aisle, we'll get more into his background later, but I would not dismiss him as being inept, even though that this is his first term.
And by freshman, that's their first year or just first term?
Well, if it's the first term, but this is truly his first year. He just got elected in 2024 and took office this year.
Doesn't everybody get committee assignments when they come on board?
Yes, I just didn't check out his. See what
oh no, I'm with you. I'm not challenging that. You just, but like everybody gets some kind of committee.
It may be the supply committee. You know, the pay, but yes, everybody's going to get usually some committee. But whether it's a powerful committee or not, that's what I'm talking about. But I think this guy might have the ability to do something based on his own campaign website. Okay. He states, I have always lived by the pledge to be engaged in doing good things. I have lived in Arizona for the majority of my life and have lived in Gilbert for over 25 years. I was an employee of the Phoenix, Arizona Police Department and the Federal Bureau of Investigation. Now, he didn't say he was an officer, but I would hate to think that he swept the floor for both of those agencies, and he's putting that on his campaign website. But if he has former law enforcement experience of any magnitude, that gives him an additional license to do things, because he would never turn loose a tidal wave of crime like AOC would do, or someone from the liberal side of the aisle. And so he gets a pass. So Kyle Powell might be able to pull this off.
Now, so based on what you just said there, that seems pretty solid as far as like a cred. So, but what's wrong with it though?
Well, there are several things wrong with it.
There you go again. Of course, you are Mr. Doom and Gloom. So go back to your, try to reach down deep inside yourself and find anything that's good about this bill.
Well, yes, there's something good about the bill. It's been sponsored and introduced, and it's got potential for passing, but there are problems that would need to be fixed.
Then please enlighten us.
Well, there are at least five identifiable problems that are in the bill as I see it. First, the language refers to the person as a defendant. Did you notice that?
I did, yes.
Well, since registration of PFRs is a civil regulatory scheme that flows as a consequence of a prior conviction, the person should never be referred to as a defendant when they're in a civil regulatory regime trying to get excused from further compliance. They correctly refer to the person later on in the bill as petitioner, but I'm suggesting that they always refer to the person as petition or individual, but do not use defendant. That changes the whole look of the individual. If you're a defendant in court, I mean, yes, you can be a civil defendant, but if they leave that defendant language in there, that already starts the clock against you.
All right. Well, that makes some sense at least. So then what next?
Well, the language says, you read it, it says petition the court. What court would they petition? This needs clarity. And I suggest that they file the petition in the Superior Court, and that's the Court of General Jurisdiction, of the county of their residence.
Now, okay, so that seems kind of clever to me. Then they would avoid going back to the county of conviction, which can be very problematic. Then what's next?
You got that right. That could be very problematic, because depending on what kind of angst they have against you, and depending on the size of the county, you may have a lot harder battle getting off the registry, assuming they were to make this thing law.
But that's what they do in Georgia, Larry. You have to, if you are from out of state, you get to petition the county you're in. If you got convicted and you're still living there, you have to go back to the county of conviction.
And I want to avoid that. But since they didn't specify county, I'm recommending that they put the county of residence. And that will give the people the opportunity, since the bulk of the population in Arizona is going to live in the Maricopa, Phoenix area, or in Tucson, I forget the name of that county. But the majority of the people are going to live in that part of the state. So we would give more relief potential to those in those counties, because I'm assuming that the courts would be more equipped and more likely not to have the ability to push back as hard. But certainly you need to figure out where you're going to file a petition. You just don't say the court. That's a big omission there.
All right. Well, that makes some sense. So then what else?
Well, the language says, may call witnesses and introduce evidence, any reliable and relevant evidence. Well, I don't know exactly how to narrow this down just yet, but you don't want that language. The problem for petitioners is that the state will attempt to retry the case and focus on the original conduct that occurred at least by statute 10 years previously. And if they can do that, if they get to relitigate the case and just read from the complaint and have the victim give a victim impact story, you ain't going to get off the registry. Virtually nobody will be removed. And I offered some alternate language that I don't want to put on the air here that is a placeholder, but it needs more work because I did this on the fly trying to help them out, and that has not been incorporated in yet. But this language here, if you allow them to rehash the case, you might as well forget getting off the damn registry.
Because they kind of tried to do that when I was getting off the registry. There was nobody there in the office that had still worked there, so they were like, we oppose, but there's nobody here that remembers anything about this, so it's like, we oppose, but we're not going to push back very hard. All right, well then, also that makes some sense. Then what else do you think they should do?
Well, the evidentiary standard they established is far too high. They say clear and convincing evidence. And that's just one notch below beyond a reasonable doubt. And clear and convincing is a civil standard, so I can't fault them for that. But I do suggest that they back it down an additional notch to a preponderance of the evidence, which is more likely than not. We can't put it. Clear and convincing is so high. I'm familiar with that because that's our conditions for keeping a person in pretrial detention here. I force the state to show clear and convincing evidence that the person, that there's no set of conditions that will, they can be released, that will keep the community safe. Well, that standard is so high, the state can hardly ever meet that here. If you notice that Hollywood actor, what was his name, Busfield, just got released on his own recognizance for a PFR offense here. That would only happen in maybe a handful of our states.
Right.
But I would like to see this standard lowered from clear and convincing.
Would you do me a favor, since these are just words? I understand preponderance of the evidence means like 50 plus one, right?
Right.
And I don't, does clear and convincing mean 75%?
It doesn't have a percentage, but in a civil, the jury would be instructed to the effect that the evidence doesn't have to be, that there's no doubt, but it has to be, you have to be clearly convinced that this defendant in the civil suit is responsible for those damages. And beyond a reasonable doubt is what they use in a criminal case. And there's no exact definition. A judge will tell you it's what causes a reasonable person to have doubt about the validity of returning a guilty verdict. But they don't ever tell you what beyond reasonable doubt means. It's all up to each individual juror.
Sure. Okay. All right. Well, then let's keep moving. What else do you have?
Well, the language is far too restrictive. They have to prove that the PFR has to prove that they're not a danger to the community. And they have to prove that by clear and convincing evidence, but that's far too vague. The registry does not try to prevent danger to the community. If you apply that standard, everybody presents danger to the community. If you're alive, unless you're homebound and can't get out of bed, there's some danger. The language should be narrowed to not a danger to commit a crime of violence. And I would even prefer a sexual crime, but definitely a crime of violence. But to say not a danger to the community, that you have to prove that by clear and convincing evidence, you've got a system where it was one step above not having a removal process, but not much better than that. If this were to actually be enacted, there'd be very few people getting off.
I like the way that you framed that of, if you're trying, you're trying to prove a negative, which is really hard to do, but you're trying to go before court and try to provide evidence that you are no longer a threat. And you have no evidence to prove anything other than to say that you're not going to do it. Anyway, do you think that this will pass?
Not sure. There will be some staunch opposition out there. I have already heard from the Arizonans that there's a victims advocacy group that's already lining up their media support, and they're already planning on trying to push back pretty hard.
Now, would you recommend that all of the PFRs go gather and form a large contingent and show up at the Capitol?
I fail to see what purpose that would serve.
I do not recommend that. I think that that would be counterproductive. I think with this bill is likely to be high profile, the victims' advocates apparatus will make sure that it is. It'll be covered on the news when it's heard in committee. And if a whole bunch of PFRs were to testify, they would spin that as that this is an example of how the PFRs are trying to do. I mean, it would just be ugly. But I would think that would have too much risk and too little reward. So I would not do that if we were doing that here. I wouldn't bring a bunch of PFRs.
Well, all right. We do have a little bit. It's only 40 minutes. If you saw this bill show up in your legislative body, what would you do? Like, do you start going and shaking hands and kissing babies and trying to talk to the legislators to see if they would support it? How do you move it, like, from that angle?
Well, that's a good question. Well, if this it's doubtful a bill like this would just show up here, but if it did show up, because it didn't just show up, the Arizona group was working on it. They've been trying to get something to allow pathway off the registry, and this is their first draft. I think they had a bill previous year that maybe didn't get a hearing, but this is their first solid attempt where they're trying to get this done. But what they need to do now is to get with the legislative council, whatever they call their drafting service. They need to get the sponsor. They need to get Representative Powell to empower someone who has expertise in the subject matter to help the legislative drafter come up with language that will cure some of these deficits. But the first conversation I'd have would be Representative Powell. Do you actually want this to work, or is this window dressing? Because if we want to get people off the registry, this will not work. This has too many pitfalls, and virtually no one will be released. But if he's serious about wanting to thin out the registry, and if he says yes, I would say, well, good, I'm going to give you some talking points for why we need to thin out the registry. Talking points are helpful, because if he gets cornered by a reporter in the hallways of the Capitol and he's caught off guard, why are you getting ready to turn all these hundreds, if not thousands, of people off the registry? He needs to have his talking points. He needs to have, well, what we're trying to do is we're trying to focus on those who have committed more recent crimes that pose a greater threat. And with limited resources, and in fact that I've been running on a no tax increase campaign, I want to make the best use of the resources we have. So we're trying to thin out the older offenders from the registry. But I would get him prepared with talking points. And I would get with the drafter if he would authorize me, because usually they can authorize a person to work directly with the bill drafter. And I would get language that's better in there before it gets to the committee to be heard. If it gets to the committee in this format, it's possible to change it, amend it in the committee. But if you wait to that stage and you don't have it in good draft form and you get to the committee stage, you're in an uphill battle, because they have to do the amendment right there when they're hearing it, if they operate like we do. And trying to find the right language when you've got 12 people looking at you is much more difficult. So that's what I would be doing if I were running this show. But I'm not running this show. I'm only an advisor.
I understand. Well, fantabulous. That is totally a word. Anything else before we head out?
Well, this turned out to be a little bit shorter, but it's 42 minutes we had. And I've got a snowstorm possibly coming in. I know you've got one going in, so I ask we start earlier tonight. And I apologize for those throngs of people that would have been here, but I don't want to be stranded on one side of town and not able to get to the other side. And so it's going to get me out here before the snow is predicted to come.
I do want to make sure that we announce that we did get a new patron. So thank you, Andrew, for coming aboard at the stimulus check level. That was very generous of them.
What was that level stimulus? Well, there was three of those. Which level did he come in at? Was it 1,400 or 1,200?
That's all I'm thinking of is the 14.
Oh, he came in at the 1,400 level? That's really good.
Yeah.
And everybody don't take us seriously. Nobody's doing stimulus level.
So, annually, we got a couple close.
That's true. We've got a couple that would be right at that annual basis.
Well, very good. Well, head over to registrymatters.co and you can find show notes and links everywhere that you would need to go, and email us at registrymatterscast@gmail.com. You can send us an old-fashioned voicemail message at 747-227-4477. As an alternative, you could record a voice memo and email that to us at the aforementioned email address. And then, of course, as Andrew has done, support us on Patreon at patreon.com/registrymatters to support the work that we do here. We are independent creators, and You know, this is sort of a labor of love, so to speak, and it certainly doesn't pay the mortgage. Right?
It doesn't? I thought that we were pulling down $100K a year each off of this.
Yeah, sure. And then, of course, you can go over to fypeducation.org/shop and find the fantabulous merchandise that Registry Matters has there, especially the Doom and Gloom shirt. You know, I was editing some videos, and there was a guy at the conference, the MC, and he had won a shirt when we did the live recording, and he was wearing it the next day. And it's a civil regulatory scheme. It's not punishment. It's a civil regulatory scheme shirt. It was funny. It was cracking me up.
Well, it's funny because I've got one of those shirts myself, and I'm going to start wearing it.
You should totally do it. It's hard to kind of like figure out something that gets the point across but doesn't out you. Like there were some other shirts presented at a conference that said like, "I am a sex offender" or something like that. It's like, no one's going to wear those. No one's going to even want those. But if you have something that's a little bit, you know, 2 or 3 degrees away from what it is, it's perfectly fine.
Well, it truly is a civil regulatory scheme until the courts say it is not. And we're going back on the air again, but until we do a better job of proving that intent affects test, rather than griping about it, we just need to build a solid case and go in with proof and quit whining and do our jobs. And that's what's going to win this and turn it around. But it's not necessarily that the courts are wrong. It's that we haven't litigated as effectively as we should.
Yep. Understand. All right. Well, then I hope everybody has a great night and great weekend. And if you are in the path of Snowmageddon, I hope you stay warm and toasty and safe and so forth and so on. And I will talk to you soon, my friend. And I hope you have a great night.
Good night.
You've been listening to FYP.